I'm aware of what a privilege it is to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to all of the great ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Well, today's talk is about interdependent origination, sometimes called dependent co-arising. Listen to the lyrics of this old popular song called I Am My Own Grandpa, which couldn't express Dogen's point more precisely. So here's I Am My Own Grandpa. Now, many, many years ago, when I was 23, I was married to a widow who was pretty as could be. This widow had a grown-up daughter who had hair of red. My father fell in love with her, and soon the two were wed. This made my dad my son-in-law and changed my very life. My daughter was my mother, because she was my father's wife. To complicate the matter, even though it brought me joy, I soon became the father of a bouncing baby boy. My little baby then became the brother-in-law to Dad, and so he became my uncle, though it made me very sad. For if he was my uncle, that also made him the brother of the widow's grown-up daughter, who, of course, was my stepmother. Chorus. I am my own grandpa. I am my own grandpa. It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so, for I am my own grandpa. Then it goes on. My father's wife then had a son that kept him on the run, and he became my grandchild, for he was my daughter's son. My wife is now my mother's mother, and it makes me blue because she is my wife. Because she is my wife, she's my grandmother too. Chorus. Now, if my wife is my grandmother, then I'm her grandchild. And every time I think of it, it nearly drives me wild. For now I have become the strangest case you ever saw. As husband of my grandmother, I am my own grandpa. I love this song. And, you know, we see it all over the place. And this is so exquisitely described. But talk about interdependent origination. There you have it in a nutshell. Maybe the talk is over. But actually, it's this point of co-arising, of interdependent, the interconnected whole. That is what Shakyamuni Buddha, in his moment of awakening, that's what he awakened to under the Bo tree. That was his amazing discovery. At that moment, he discovered interdependent origination, that we're all connected, this is one entire being. Our lives are one entire being. And Suzuki Roshi used the image of front and back feet when we walk, like you can never tell. We walk and like which one is the right foot and which one is the left, and it gets very confusing quickly. And because everything is so intertwined, that's a Suzuki Roshi's metaphor. So today I'm going to introduce two of Dogen's wakas that explore this theme in slightly different ways. As so far as you've seen, the wakas themselves don't seem to say very much, But underneath, and I think in Japanese, the subtleties that the Japanese language can convey, they actually are very poignant. And thanks to Okamura Roshi, who's translated them and who explains the Japanese, we can experience how profound they are. So the first poem for today is called Miscellaneous Poem Written at the Grass Hut. In my grass hut, sleeping or waking, I always recite. I take refuge in Shakyamuni Buddha. Bestow your compassion upon us. Again, in my grass hut, sleeping or waking, I always recite, I take refuge in Shakyamuni Buddha, bestow your compassion upon us. And Okamura Roshi reminds us that in the Shobo Genzo fascicle called Mind of the Way, Dogen wrote, asleep and awake, we should consider the merit of the three treasures. Asleep and awake, we should chant the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. For Dogen, Shakyamuni Buddha was not one particular Buddha among many Buddhas, but in his Shobo Genzo fascicle, The Mind Itself is Buddha, he wrote, the term all Buddhas refers to Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni is nothing other than mind itself is Buddha. All Buddhas in the past, present, and future, when they become Buddha, unfailingly become Shakyamuni Buddha. And this is mind itself is Buddha. And that's how we are all Buddhas, actually. We just aren't awakened to that fact. Or the experience. And this is because when we awaken, we become a Buddha who not only knows intellectually that all beings are interconnected, but actually experience this. So if we are all beings, then we are Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha, when he awakened, said, I, along with all beings, have awakened to the truth of reality. That's what he said. It wasn't that he awakened alone. Actually, there's no such thing as awakening alone. There's no such thing. I, along with all beings, have awakened to the truth of reality. So Okamura Roshi continues, my teacher, Uchiyama Roshi, had ill health throughout his life, and from his early 20s, he lived with tuberculosis. And when he couldn't practice Zazen, he repeated the name of Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, and he chanted Namu Kanzeon Bosatsu, literally homage to Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. And he often said that Zazen and chanting a Buddha's or Bodhisattva's name, whether Shakyamuni, Amitabha, or Avalokiteshvara, are basically the same. These merely are different names for the total functioning of the network of interdependent origination through which we are enabled to live. So this idea of the network of total functioning, the network of total functioning of interdependent origination through which we're entitled to live. In one of his books, Opening the Hand of Thought, Uchiyama Roshi wrote, this small I is embraced by the immeasurable and boundless Amitabha Buddha. It does not depend on whether I believe it or not. I am, in fact, embraced and saved by the immeasurable and boundless Amitabha. Being thankful for this, I chant Namu Amitabha Butsu. When we say this with our mouths, we are expressing our deep sense of gratitude. When we perform it with our whole body, it is Zazen, as the activity of the reality of life, the Zazen of believing and sitting. When people of the Pure Land School chant Namu Amida Butsu, they are doing Zazen with their mouths. And when we do Zazen, we are performing Namu Amida Butsu with our whole body. I always feel a little uncomfortable with practices like that, because they are Pure Land Buddhism and Zen is not that. But Dogen really was a student of Pure Land Buddhism before he became a Zen practitioner, before he went to China. So we have to have respect for that. The pointing out instruction of this waka that I just read to you is asleep and awake, we should consider the merit of the three treasures. Asleep and awake, we should chant the three treasures, which are merely different names for the total functioning of the network of interdependent origination through which we are enabled to live. That's when I say pointing out instruction, that's a kind of Rinzai Zen code word for the teacher, usually the Roshi, pointing out the meaning of the koan that the student is working on. I'm just kind of in fun adapting that expression, the pointing out instruction of these wakas, but that it reminds us that these wakas were teaching devices for Dogen. He wasn't really writing poetry. He was writing teaching devices for his students. And these are easy to remember, so they could chant them over and over if they wanted. And it's so like Dogen to tell us that even in our sleep, we should consider the merit of the three treasures. Don't forget that Dogen is the one who wrote with big letters, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, on pieces of paper and wrapped them around a pillar in his sick room as he was dying. And when he could muster the energy, he circumambulated this pillar and just chanted Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. This is what he took refuge in, basically on his deathbed. And so when he encourages us to, asleep and awake, chant the names of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, he means that we should be imbued at all times with the three refuges, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, as he was. Interdependent origination and impermanence are arguably the two most important Buddhist teachings. I mean, if you want to boil down Buddhism to, you know, anything, those would be the two that you would boil it down to: impermanence, that impermanence is real, just look in the mirror, and interdependent, everything is interconnected. Just think of where your food comes from and you'll get a sense. So even if we don't experience ourselves this way, we exist inextricably entangled with all other beings, sentient and insentient. And this is an ultimate truth that we can't fully grasp with our thinking minds, but it's certain that we don't exist as independent individuals that as we think we do. So you may not see this stated directly in the waka, but the passion behind the words carries the teaching, sometimes in order to hear the Dharma we have to be very quiet and listen underneath to what's being said. I'm going to read this one more time now that I've talked a little bit. In my grass hut, sleeping or waking, I always recite, I take refuge in Shakyamuni Buddha, bestow your compassion on us. So even if what's conveyed here is his passion and how saturated he is with the triple treasure, it's his whole life. And he wishes that for us. So here is another poem expressing this truth in a slightly different way. At the moment, my ears hear voices as they are. Everyone I speak with is my friend. Once again, at the moment, my ears hear voices as they are. That's the trick. Voices as it were. We don't really hear voices as they are. Everyone I speak with is my friend. And Okamura Roshi says that there's a double negative in the Japanese, so that its literal translation is, there is no one I talk with who is not my friend. But in the Shobogenzo Genjo Koan, Dogen says, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all beings. To be verified by all beings is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. There is a trace of realization that cannot be grasped. We endlessly keep expressing this ungraspable trace of realization. And Okamura Roshi explains, the time of dropping off body and mind of the self and others is when we hear a voice or sound as it is, without our overlay, without our fictitious interpretations and really self-centered judgments that we know what we heard. There's this whole, it goes back to, I think last time, that it's our minds that get in the way of our experiencing reality as it is. So when he says, at the moment, my ears hear voices as they are, and it's our minds that keep us from doing that. And so Okamura Roshi explains, the time of dropping off body and mind of self and others, this is when we're released from clinging to our own five aggregates. And I've talked about the five skandhas. Aggregates is another name for skandhas. And that means our bodies, our sensations, our perceptions, our mental formations, and consciousness. Those five things in Buddhism, it's explained that that's what we're made of, and that's why we're impermanent. And when we drop this off, as we can in Zazen, colors and shapes are seen as they are, and sounds and voices are heard as they are. So in other words, to actually hear the sound without the overlay of our minds. That's what Dogen is talking about. And when that happens for him, he says, everyone I speak with is my friend. That is, he sees the interconnectedness of all beings. That's what that's saying. When I actually can hear voices as they are, immediately everyone is my friend. Immediately I feel the interconnectedness of the universe. So we're not released from the clinging to the five aggregates, Okamura explains. Contact with objects with our sense organs, we're not released, and then contact with any object causes pleasant and unpleasant and neutral sensations. So according to Buddhist teaching, this is really basic Buddhist teaching now, perceptions form from these sensations. So there's sensations and then perceptions, and then we develop preferences, and then we pursue what we like and dislike. And this is why we perform wholesome and unwholesome actions that produce good and bad karma. And this is what makes our life into samsara. This little procedure I just described, we're always chasing after things we want and trying to escape from things we don't want. Our life goes up and down depending on whether we're successful or not, and we lose a stable foundation. So I want to pause and go over this again, because this is one of Shakyamuni Buddha's two basic teachings. One was the Four Noble Truths, and the other is called the 12 Nidanas. And Nidanas are links of causation, causing samsara and causing recycling through birth and death. And it begins with ignorance. Ignorance is the first link of causation. I'm not going to go over those 12 right now, but just to give you an idea of this core teaching, both of these core teachings, if invested in wholeheartedly, lead to the end of the cycles of birth and death. So these aren't just little things. They're like how to get out of samsara. And the 12 links of causation, this teaching called the 12 Nidanas, part of it, the middle of it, begins, the middle of it is our five sense organs interact with objects. So we our sight interacts with an object of our sight, and then there's consciousness of the object of the sight. And so we develop perceptions, which develop into preferences, likes and dislikes, which create craving, and then grasping, and then clinging, and so forth. And the and so forth includes sickness, old age, and death. So this is the cycle of samsara that we do. We do this ourselves. We all do it. We cycle through birth to starting with, when we are born, we start with ignorance, and there's a number of them, and it gets to our preferences, grasping, clinging, craving, etc. And then old age, sickness, death, rebirth. So we're in this cycle of constant birth and death. And Shakyamuni Buddha said, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm going to find a way to stop it. And he did. And he proceeded to teach the Four Noble Truths all his life. We've talked about this. Beginning, middle, and end. On his deathbed, he was teaching the Four Noble Truths, because following them, and especially the Eightfold Path, we can get out of samsara. So this path, the 12 Nidanas, are the same thing, only for people of a slightly different temperament. So we can pick. So the Four Noble Truths and practitioners of Shakyamuni Buddha, when he lived and in his lifetime, they accomplished one or the other of these two practices, and they were called arhats. And arhats, the definition of an arhat is one who attains full extinction immediately following this life. So these two paths aren't nothing. They're very serious practices to get ourselves out of this trap that we've created for ourselves. And it's called samsara. And our arhats have followed one or the other of those two paths, and they've, and then at the end of this life, it's over for them. They don't have to transmigrate again. Okamura Roshi continues, hearing sound as it is not some mystical way of hearing, but rather letting go moment by moment of the thoughts and feelings triggered by our contact with objects. We refrain from making concepts about objects and taking action based on these concepts. He gives an example of when he's doing zazen. He says, in autumn, we hear a chorus of insects during early morning and evening zazen. In Japanese poetry, we call such sounds, and then he has these Japanese words, mushi shigure. Mushi means insect, and shigure means intermittent drizzling rain, particularly in autumn or early winter. So the insect's chorus is like the sound of rainfall. And he says, this reminds me of a short phrase in a traditional Japanese song that I heard on the radio program many years ago when I was a student, he's saying. And the phrase in the chorus is, within the chorus of insect sounds, I too am an insect. Within the chorus of insect sounds, like rainfall, I too am an insect. So the person hearing the insects sing, feels at one with them. And I know I experienced something very similar to this in the St. Louis summer time, and hearing this loud insect singing, it just overcomes you and you do feel at one with them. So when we hear simple sounds, we do not feel separation between subject and object. There's no trace of I as subject, hearing as an activity, or the sound as an object. This intermittent hearing before separation between listener and sound, as intimate friends within the network of interdependent origination, we're simply sitting and insects are just chirping without interaction. We are living together. And you might remember Suzuki Roshi's word, independency, which does what it says. It's both. It's although things are interdependent with respect to each other, at the same time, each being is independent. And Suzuki Roshi used to say, when each being includes the whole world, then each being is actually independent. Suzuki Roshi explains lines from the Sandokai from the viewpoint of independency. Eye and sight, sound, and ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste. It looks, Roshi says, as if Sikito Kisan, the author of the Sandokai, is actually talking dualistically about the dependency of eyes and their objects. But when you see something, if you see it in its true sense, there is nothing to be seen and no one to see it. Only when you analyze it is there someone seeing something and something that is seen. It is one activity that can be understood in two ways. I see something, but really there is no one seeing it and nothing to be seen. Both of these are true. Here, Sikito is talking about this oneness of eye and form. This is how Buddhists observe things. We understand things in a dualistic way, but we don't forget that our understanding is dualistic, so that it's not reality. I hope you're understanding this. We see, as Buddhists, we see things both in from the ultimate truth standpoint. We just know that that's so, even though we don't experience it ourselves yet. And we also know what we do experience ourselves, that, you know, this object is over there and I'm seeing it. But we don't forget that this is dualistic. An ordinary person who's not studying Buddhism just sees things and they don't even think about dualism. And Suzuki Roshi goes on, maybe you killed, you've heard this before in his earwig talk, maybe, but it's relevant right now. Maybe you will kill some animal or insect, Suzuki Roshi continues. But when you think, there are many earwigs here and they are harmful insects, so I have to kill this one, you understand this only in a dualistic way. There's me and there's the earwig. Actually, earwigs and human beings are one. They are not different. It is impossible to kill an earwig. Even though we think we have killed it, we have not. Even though you squash the earwig, it is still alive. That momentary form may vanish, but as long as the whole world, including us, exists, we cannot kill an earwig. When we come to this understanding, we can keep our precepts completely. You know, because we vow, I will not kill. But when we understand that it's impossible to kill, then we can keep our precept, I will vow to not kill. So Roshi is saying that you can observe our world from a dualistic point of view and from the point of view of the absolute, which is Buddha nature. It is not good to kill is a dualistic viewpoint. And even though you think you killed, you did not kill, is an absolute viewpoint. And understanding things in this way, we have oneness. So the pointing out instruction of this waka is, intimate hearing takes place before separation and between listener and sound. As intimate friends within the network of interdependent origination, we are simply sitting and insects are just chirping without interaction. We are living together. I'll read the waka one more final time. At the moment, my ears hear voices as they are. Everyone I speak with is my friend, which means I experience the oneness of reality. Here are some of the most important points from today's talk, but I want to say that while we're going through Dogen's waka, and maybe next his kanchi, Chinese kanchi, a short series on that, I want to keep each talk focused on one teaching, just really one main teaching, so that you don't get confused. And when you leave this talk, even if there were things you didn't understand, you can always just go back to, this talk was about interdependent origination. And that's the only thing you need to try to understand. And it is hard. We can understand it from an experiential point of view to a certain extent, but actually, it was the thing that Shakyamuni Buddha realized on his awakening. So it's an ultimate truth, and we can only fully experience it when we're awakened. But I just want to say that these talks on Dogen's poetry, each talk is about one main point. So not to go away thinking, oh, this was so confusing. I hope you don't. And here are what I picked out as some of the most important points. There are seven of them. First, Dogen's awake and asleep. We should consider the merit of the three treasures. Awake and asleep. We should chant the three treasures. Second, all Buddhas in the past, present, and future, when they become Buddha, unfailingly become Shakyamuni Buddha. This is mind itself is Buddha. Mind itself is Buddha. Third, the time of dropping off body and mind of self and others is when we hear a voice or sound as it is, without our fictitious interpretation and self-centered judgment, with basically without our mind, our intellectual overlay and everything to keep us from experiencing reality. The example of walking as expressing how this oneness functions. When you walk, the step ahead immediately becomes the step behind, and it's hard to tell the difference. It's a great functional example of this oneness. And fifth, when we see the emptiness of ourselves and the objects of our sense organs, when we see the emptiness of I and the object of sight, we are released from transmigration, birth and death, and we discover a stable way of life. And this comes from Zazen, by the way. That's our practice, and that's how all of this understanding will come about for us. Sixth, Shakyamuni Buddha, when he awakened, said, I, along with all beings, have awakened to the truth of reality. I, along with all beings. It wasn't that he awakened alone. And actually, there's no such thing as awakening alone. And seventh, this oneness of I and form. This is how Buddhists observe things. We understand things in a dualistic way, but we don't forget that our understanding is dualistic. And here are some ideas for reflection during the week. First, because I have found it so useful and time optimizing to have a handy short phrase that I can substitute in my mind when I see junk in it, I'd like to suggest that you make one for yourself. Something that touches your heart in less than 5 words. And it could be Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha like Dogen. So when your mind goes to junk, you can immediately think, if you want, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Buddha, you see blah, 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 and you go, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And you can just do it even rotely. You can just do it by rote. I have a different one, but it comes from my Tibetan Buddhist days. And it wouldn't be relevant for you, but I use it a lot. I use it every single day. And I use it when I'm driving, for example, and I'm in traffic, or irritating delays with all this construction. It's very, very handy to really clean your mind. So I recommend that to you as one reflection point during the week to create something like that for yourself. And second, without knowing more than what we said today about the 12 Nidanas, the 12 links of causation that keep us locked into samsara. So there's 12. There's 12 things that go in order that we do all the time that keep us locked into samsara. And I've mentioned quite a number of them today. So without knowing more, though, than what I mentioned today, explain that truth to yourself using experiences from your own life. For example, unpack for yourself a situation where desire led to craving, then to grasping, and then to clinging. We all do this, but it's good to demonstrate the teaching from your own daily life. So just stay with those four: desire to craving, to grasping, to clinging. And just see, just look at your life and just see how that goes. Because this is a very important teaching. And if you really get into it, it can lead you out of samsara. So third, okay, this is kind of a test. This is why the teaching of non-discrimination is known. Never mind. I'm going to skip this because I think the test was, remember that phrase, I have no complaints whatsoever. And that's the same as what I talked about in the 12 Nidanas. But can you explain that to yourself? That's the test. Can you explain that to yourself? How is I have no complaints whatsoever related to the 12 Nidanas? And the fourth one, within the chorus of insect sounds, I too am an insect. The resonance of this seems obvious, but can you articulate its deeper meaning? And there's seven of them today. The fifth one is, what does Dogen's phrase, mind itself is Buddha, mean to you? What does that mean to you? Mind itself is Buddha, because you have a mind. So what does that say to you? And also, what does Dogen's word, there is a trace of realization that cannot be grasped. We endlessly keep expressing this ungraspable trace of realization. What does that mean to you? We endlessly keep expressing this ungraspable trace of realization. And last but not least, why is it impossible to kill an earwig? That's all. Why is it impossible to kill an earwig? And those reflection questions are posted on the website. And I so hope that you take the trouble to look at them and articulate your answers to them, because that will help you really take in and make your own the teachings in these Dharma talks. I wonder if you have any questions.
Yes, Gail. The first question that we have is, this is a kind of big question, but I hear the word silence a lot in these teachings. And I wonder why silence or quiet is so important. Nature is not silent. Animals and birds and whales, even the air is not silent. Could you explain?
Buddhist teaching mentions this all the time about if we want to know who we really are, we have to touch the real silent, deep nature of ourselves and our lives. How is to sit zazen? That's why sitting is so important to us. It allows us to touch our actual nature. And when zazen does zazen, our actual nature manifests. And when our actual nature manifests, it includes the entire universe. So it's not just our individual personality, but simultaneously through our individual personality, the whole universe manifests because of the interconnectedness that we were talking about today. On this note, I want to add that it's really worrisome about young people today in this context. There's many wonderful things about young people today, but in this context, if you look at any TV screen for less than a minute, all you see is frenzy and loudness and unstillness. And it's worrisome. But the answer to your question is really that our real nature, in order to see it, we have to be silent. And when we see our real nature, we see the entire interconnected universe. And that's why it's so important in Buddhism. As I said in the talk, if you boil Buddhism down to two things, it would be two teachings. It would be interconnected origination and impermanence. Those are the two main teachings in Buddhism. So to even touch the interconnectedness, we have to be silent. And that's why it's mentioned constantly. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Next one we have is, would you please explain again, mind itself is Buddha?
I want to refer you back to last week, or the first talk, when the Chinese Buddhist nun was translating and experienced Shakyamuni Buddha giving the Lotus Sutra, offering the Lotus Sutra to his assembly right now on Vulture Peak, right now. And that's true right now. We don't experience because we're not enlightened, but the truth is that Shakyamuni Buddha is giving the Lotus Sutra to his assembly, which is us, right now. So, and actually, if we listened hard enough, we would hear that, we would know that, because our mind itself is Buddha. Our mind itself is Buddha. Why? How can we say that? Because of the interconnected whole of the entire universe. You could ask the opposite question. Could you explain how Buddha, when he awoke, awoke with this earth and all beings at the same time? That's mind itself as Buddha. That's mind itself as Buddha, because Buddha's awakening included all beings. So that means that we are Buddhas, only we're not, we have to practice in order to experience that. That's the whole point of practice. Dogen was driven crazy by this problem of, well, if Buddha nature is everywhere, why do I have to practice? And he went to China to find an answer to that question, which was very dangerous in his time. He went to China and he went all around China and he couldn't find a teacher to answer that question until he finally at the bitter end found his teacher, and it solved the great matter of life and death for that endlessly, you know, then for him, the great matter of life and death was solved. And that's also mind itself as Buddha. Everything really is Buddha. It's an ultimate truth, and it's hard for us to understand with our minds. And that's why there's a difficulty. But hearing the ultimate truths expressed, even if we don't understand, I think that it's still useful. It's still useful because we know the direction we're going in. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the question is, this is actually from the first talk, but I've been wondering, why does Dogen say that literature is meaningless and that his indulgence of reading it should cease immediately?
I know. Well, I shouldn't laugh because he does have a good reason. And the reason is, well, I laugh because he does it anyway. But the reason he says it is that he knows that it's very difficult to get a human incarnation. In Buddhism, it's taught very clearly that it's very difficult to get, just ignore that, I'm sorry. It's very difficult to get a human incarnation. I don't want to waste any more of your time, but I have to ignore that. And now that we have a human incarnation, we have to use it for its main purpose, to attain enlightenment, because the human incarnation is the only incarnation where enlightenment is possible to attain. We're the only incarnation. Animals can't do it. Hungry ghosts can't do it. Hell beings can't do it. Even the gods can't do it. And the angry asuras can't do it. Only human beings can attain enlightenment. So in this short lifetime, there's really nothing more important to put our attention to. So it might be lovely to read literature, but when we consider that we only have this one short lifetime to do this one big thing, we shouldn't be diddling it our time away. And so he's kind of emphatic about that. And yet he both reads and writes literature. so there's human nature for you. But that's why. It's sort of humorous to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next one is, this refers back to last week, but regarding the idea where there is suffering, there is joy of suffering. I don't think honestly that there is a chance for me to get there. I don't see myself ever being able to find joy when I'm miserable.
The misunderstanding here is in the word suffering. And probably when you say miserable, probably you're referring to times in your life, circumstances that are miserable. But when Shakyamuni Buddha uses the word suffering, he means the cycles of life and death. He means sickness, old age, and death, which is inevitable for each and every human being, including myself and all of you listening. We all are going to suffer sickness, old age, and death again and again and again if we don't do something about it. And so when he says life is suffering, he means that suffering. And to end that suffering, he gave us the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, and he also gave us the teaching of the 12 Nidanas, which is just a more logical showing you how, link by link, and there are 12 of them, we create this for ourselves. The Four Noble Truths are just, especially the fourth one, which has the Eightfold Noble Path of how to live. There's eight instructions for us of how to live. And those are two ways to go about getting out of the cycles of birth and death, which Buddha called suffering. So I think that's the misunderstanding. He really wasn't talking about circumstantial suffering. He's talking about suffering in the overall, just that you're here in the first place is suffering. And it is, because we all are going to go through all of this, including the 12 Nidanas. We're going to all do it. We're going to do it again and again and again until we like get a clue, and then we start noticing, and then we start paying attention, and we start stopping, and then we start realizing what's behind all that, and we get out of our dualistic consciousness. I have the feeling that we're close to out of time. And so I may not take any more questions. And I want to be sure to thank my team, Brendan and Brian and Sahar, for all of the work, the endless work that they do under, in some ways, treacherous circumstances like Pakistan today. Sahar lives in Pakistan. All this for us. So thank you so much. I will see you next week. Bye-bye.